And to keep the flow in the other direction, now I can turn it off. Okay, so let's start. I want to move on from our study of the wave equation as the archetypical hyperbolic equation. I want to go on to general hyperbolic equations, and that's under, and the first thing I'll do is constant coefficient hyperbolic equations. And the thing I'll do after that is actually fully nonlinear hyperbolic equations, or at least quasi-linear hyperbolic equations, but I'll do the symmetric hyperbolic case, a very important class. I'll see how far I can get in symmetric hyperbolic in our second hour today. But the first hour, let's start with even the definition of what it means to be a hyperbolic equation. So let's section 4.6, Gordings condition of hyperbolicity. I was just asking for pronunciation lessons in for Chinese names, but now I need a Swedish lesson on how to properly pronounce Gording. Gording, not so far off? Thanks. So I'm interested in constant coefficient. So this is basic. I'm going to define what it means to be hyperbolic later. What interests us in this blackboard is constant coefficient PDE. And I'm going to use Fourier integral techniques. So you might say, by rights, it belongs in our section last semester where we talked about did the Fourier transform and everything. It's just maybe not so introductory. So maybe it's also by rights here. So when we study constant coefficient PDE, we use the Fourier transform. And everyone knows when you use the Fourier transform, it's useful to use the notation that D, oh, and I'm going to have constant coefficient PDE, so X is going to be in Rn. And I'm going to designate one extra variable, X naught, and I'll call it T, and that will be in R. So I'm working in Rn plus 1, and it's going to be a Cauchy problem or an evolution problem, so X naught will play a special role. Okay? Sorry, on R1. So you X, comma T. There we are. Thank you. X T is, or I should write it, T X is in Rn plus 1. And I'm not sure if X should be X naught, X1, X2, X3, or it should be X1, X2, X3. I think I'll stick with T X, because T is a special role. And of course the notation is D. It's a it's a vector operator, D1 up to Dn. Then I want that to be minus I or 1 upon I. Whoops, 1 upon I partial x1 dot 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 1 upon I partial xn. And I need time derivatives. So maybe it's a mistake, but I'll call those tau. That's going to be 1 upon I partial by partial t, or I could be d naught, depending. Same thing, depending. I just wanted you to know that I noticed. So in this notation, to write a constant coefficient PDE is pretty simple. So we're going to study, let's make it equation 1 for the day. A polynomial P, and it's going to be a polynomial in the variables D and the variables tau, operating on a function U, equals, say, H. In all of space. So x, t, well, no. X is in Rn. And then on the hyperplane, t equals 0, which is, which you could say is, or is like Rn in Rn plus 1. I'm going to use that as a Cauchy surface. And I'm going to prescribe initial data. Well, I should say what P is. I didn't do that yet. So study a polynomial of degree M. That's what P is. And let me give the data later. What I want to say is something about the polynomial. So that is P, if I put in C and lambda for the two variables D and tau, so C is in Rn, lambda in R, this is a polynomial. And as I said, it's constant coefficient, so it's independent of x. And it's called the symbol of x. Oh, sorry. The symbol of the equation 1. Or it could be the total symbol or the full symbol. Because somewhere else we'll talk about a principal symbol. And let's see what the initial value problem is. I started up there a little prematurely. So the initial value problem. I want to study the Cauchy problem, or actually more specifically, the initial value problem. And actually, I want a half space. So it's in half space, x in Rn, t greater than 0. And so I have to put data. So it's with data on that space I was writing up there. Take all x and Rn, but you want to set t equals 0. So that's our, what you might say, the script C of the Cauchy hypersurface. Well, what data? So, it's an nth order equation. And actually, most of the time you can just count. So I want the initial conditions. Are to be u of x 0, that is t equals 0. I want to be some function f 0 of x. And I'm going to call that equation 2 sub 0. But I also want the time derivative. So let's take this t tau, which has a 1 upon I, the time derivative of u, then evaluate that at x 0. I want that to be f sub 1. Get it, one derivative, dot, 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 up to m minus 1 time derivatives of u, evaluated at x sub 0, and I want that to be f sub m minus 1. And so these are equations up to 2 sub m minus 1, just the initial data. H can be a constant. Actually, H cannot be a constant. I want it to be a function of x and t. And so it's an inhomogeneous problem with this initial data. And it's order m, and this is m many functions, 0 through m minus 1. but we know there's an issue of being characteristic. So it's conceivable that that hyperplane is a characteristic hyperplane. We want to avoid that. That's a bad situation in general. So we want to avoid that, so I need a definition of what it means to be for C to be non-characteristic. Well, you think I wasn't keeping track, but I am. It's the 13th item in our section 4, and that is the definition of being non-characteristic. So the hyperplane, actually, I'm probably keeping track wrongly because I forgot a section. So want to give me the number? 17. I must have stuck 4 in under the time decay without keeping careful track. I'm going to take a photocopy of your notes. The hyperplane, the thing that I just wrote down, x in Rn, t equal to 0, and that's our Cauchy surface, is characteristic. Well, I don't want to say it's non-characteristic. Non-characteristic. Well, it depends on the problem. For the problem, this differential equation, partial differential equation 1, if, well, it's simply this. The coefficient p 0 p 0 m of the monomial tau to the m in the differential operator is non-zero. Now, it's a constant coefficient PDE, so that's a constant. And it's a scalar equation, so that's a constant. It's not a matrix. And I want it to be non-zero. That's what it means to be non-characteristic. So let me back up a little bit and say that is P as a function of C and lambda is, of course, a polynomial. So it's a sum P alpha L, where alpha is a multi-index, and L is a number, and I want that to be less than or equal to, greater than or equal to 0 and less than or equal to M, times C to the alpha tau to the L. And so so I have a term tau to the m in here, which comes with the coefficient p, alpha is equal to 0, and l is equal to m. That's, you might say, the most important term for our considerations. It's somewhere in there, and it's that constant I don't want to vanish. Some constant could be minus a half. It's a constant. But in fact, we don't care if it's minus one-half. Whoops. Lambda. Thank you for correcting me. Of course, if it's minus one-half, just divide by minus one-half. So without loss of generality, as long as it's non-zero, WLOG means without loss of generality, set it to be 1. Why not? Good. And we're only going to consider non-characteristic problems. I mean, without something of the form, without something being non-degenerate, who's to say what's an mth order problem? If all the mth order coefficients are 0, it's actually an m minus 1th order problem. So we want it to be genuinely of mth order, and you also want to have chosen the right direction to propagate, so I need some coefficient to be non-zero, and now let's rotate till it's that coefficient, and that's what we'll consider to be time. You could take that point of view. Okay, so, yeah? P is a polynomial. The Cauchy problem. Cauchy hypersurface is T equals zero, but T is the dual variable to lambda, right? Lambda corresponds to partial by partial T, 1 upon I partial by partial T. Make sure that that coefficient is 1. The condition is on the problem. And in some sense, I set it up so I already decided what T was, so the condition is then on the problem. And then I said it backwards in that last sentence. That's why I probably confused you, which it says, suppose you give me an arbitrary nth order polynomial in n plus 1 variables. I want to make a PDE out of it. Well, if it's nth order and not m minus 1th order, one coefficient at least is non-zero. Pick your favorite. Or you can even rotate variables and then make sure that after rotation, one coefficient is non-zero. Pick your favorite one. Call that the coefficient of the time direction. And then divide by it so it's 1, and you've now chosen your Cauchy hypersurface. Okay, everything fine? So now, a problem, abstract. In the wave equation, in the end, we didn't have to solve for all F0 through Fm minus 1 and all H. We had principles by which we solved the canonical problem, and from that, we deduced a solution for all cases. So that's also true here. So the canonical problem. So here's a proposition which continues on this. Actually, I want to take down this number. Which is that we don't have to solve for all f's, that it suffices to solve the canonical problem. Which is of the form equation 3, which goes as follows. I want to find a u which satisfies p of d tau u equals 0. So forget the homogeneity, the inhomogeneity. Forget h. How am I going to put it back? Duhamel's principle. With initial conditions for 0, u at x 0 is equal to 0, for 1 up to 4, m minus 2, tau to the m minus 2 u of x, u at x when t is equal to 0. I also want to be equal 0. And I'm just only give one piece of non-trivial initial data, 4m minus 1, which is tau m minus 1 u of x 0 is equal to a function g of x. And now I have to show that, this will suffice. Incidentally, let me ask, who's seen the solution constructed given Gording's condition before, just to know where we are? And how about the canonical problem? Yeah, more or less. No. A little bit. I'm glad. Glad we're on some new territory. Well, clearly, so here's the proof. Clearly, you construct a solution with superpositions. It's a linear equation. So use superposition. So you're going to say my solution u of xt of 1, 2 I'm going to write it equals, let's see how I did this. Some function v plus u0 plus u1 plus blah, 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 up to u m minus 1. So that's m many functions. And then where p of d tau v is going to be equal to h, and v x 0, it will equal 0, but also all derivatives t tau j v of x 0 will be 0, j equals 0 up to m minus 1. So you start out with 0 initial data, but an inhomogeneous problem. And you solve it, that's the v. And of course, what are the u0 through u1, et cetera, going to be? So that's one thing you do. Now, how do I find u0? Well, let's see. Yeah, and then I'll find p d tau u1, for example, or how about uj? That's going to solve the the homogeneous problem. And now uj will solve the following thing. L many time derivatives of uj evaluated at x 0. I want that to be equal 0 unless j is equal to l. So a way of saying that is Kronecker delta jl. In fact, I could even be clever because there's a raised index, although I'm not doing this systematically. Just Kronecker delta jl times the data that it's supposed to, that the lth derivative is supposed to pick up. And I'll solve this for j equals 0 up to m minus 1. And if I can do this, this gives me the inhomogeneous term. And each of these, of course, give me the right derivative, the right time derivative being its initial value without ruining the other values of the others. So if I can do that, then I have a canonical problem. And so the only secret is just check that you can do this solving 3 and 4. So we have to check we can do this solving 3 and 4. So we have to check that the solution of 3 and 4 can do this for us. So we have to check that. As I said, let's start with V, and we'll do that using Duhamel's principle. So let's start with V. V of x t, and you set that equal to the integral from 0 to t. Now, over here, I said that there's a canonical problem. What I want is a solution operator for this. So let's name the solution operator. So that says that the name of my solution here is u, so u of x t is equal to the solution operator t operating on g. And that's a function of x and t. So the Duhamel's principle says v is going to be the integral up to 0 to t of the solution operator t minus s, say, h of x s ds. And you can check, just as we checked 1 week ago about this time, that works. And it's the same check. It's just an abstract thing that one does. Okay, so it's up to you to check. So now we have to start putting in, the inhomogeneity, and it also has zero initial data, and we have to start checking how we can pick up all the other individual initial data. So let's do the following thing. P is a polynomial. P of C and lambda is a polynomial. Well, let's write it this way. So P of D tau is a polynomial operator with constant coefficients. And it starts out with tau to the m. So I'm going to use about probably 3 expressions for this polynomial. This is the second one already, just because there are different ways to decompose a polynomial that are useful. So it starts out with t to the m, and I can expand it, of course, in terms with powers of of tau. And the highest one is the nth power, and then of course there are lower powers times polynomial operators of higher and higher order in D. So this is a first order operator in D, and this is a plus, blah, 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 all the way down to P1 PM of D times tau to the zero. Thank you. Where we're absolutely P1 contain up to first order terms in D, but it can be zero order terms also. It's just a general polynomial with lower order terms and all. Okay, but it's just expanding P in homogeneous terms of tau. So that's a good idea. PD, PJ, C needn't be homogeneous. But it is of order less than or equal to M minus J, because there are J many tau derivatives floating around there, or J, of order J. 1 M minus 1, of order less than or equal to J. Okay, and then let's see, let's start picking off the different UJs, right? So let's start picking off the different components of this decomposition. So in particular, 3 and then 4, but M minus 1 has a solution, which is to do the following thing. Oh, that's the canonical problem. So I just say that U M minus 1 of XT is equal to the solution operator T operating on F of M minus 1, the function of X. So 4M minus 1, data 4M minus 1 is the canonical problem. Just use it. But how about if I solve equation 3, but 4M minus 2? Well, then you do the following thing. You take S, T, FM minus 2, and you create a function of X and T that way, and you do the following thing to it. You take a time derivative plus P1 of D of it, and that's UM minus 2. Of xt. And you can check that for all time derivatives less than m minus 2, this has to vanish, because that corresponds to all time derivatives less than m minus 1 in the canonical problem, which vanish. And then you use the equation to show that the m minus 1th time derivative also vanishes. And it's exactly the m minus second time derivative that's going to turn out to be f, right? And then et cetera. And you just use this procedure, so you find an expression for 3 and 4. I guess I wrote 3, 4. Well, let's just say 3, 4, 0 looks like the following thing. You set u 0 of x, and you just fill this in. It's a straightforward, is equal to the operator, but you take off one time derivative and you leave the last differential operator out. So it's tau m minus 1 plus p1 d tau m minus 2 plus all the way up to p m minus 1 d, the solution operator on f 0 of x. Well, okay, that's interesting, and it leaves a certain amount of checking to do for you. Let's just, to make this credible, maybe it's instead of a proof, maybe it's more fun to just try out the wave equation. Let's try the wave equation. So actually, I claim that this is the end of proof, modulo U checking all the dots. So let's end the proof. But let's try this on the wave equation. What was the canonical problem for the wave equation, by the way? Anyone remember that? you give zero inhomogeneous term. So it's wave operator D'Alembertian, which is the wave operator on U equals zero. Then you give initial data, initial displacement S equals zero, initial momentum G, that's your data. And from that, you can make any solution. And that's just in a nutshell this principle, but for a second order for the wave equation. So let's try it. Well, let's see. We have to study partial t squared minus Laplacian on u. And of course, that's equal to minus tau squared minus modulus of d squared operating on u. And this, of course, is supposed to be equal to a polynomial in tau and d acting on u. So it tells us what the symbol is. And the symbol, of course, is p, c, and lambda. And I guess it has this minus sign. Also, let's just put the minus sign out. It seems to be c squared minus lambda squared. And so just to check, oh, this is a capital P. I'm undecided somehow whether to use capital or small p's. And so then we just to figure what these out, well, then p 2, 0 is 1. Minus 1. I violated my principle already. Drat, minus 1 times lambda squared. Well, we'll live with it. It's supposed to be plus 1 times lambda squared, didn't I say? So then, let's see. The P20 term is minus 1. Sorry about that in here. The P1 of D term, that is the terms which are correspond to the coefficient of lambda of power 1 is 0. And P 2 of d is equal to mod d squared. And I just screwed up the sign, but just have to forgive me on that. Okay, and then we called w a solution operator. So the solution operator for the canonical problem, at least for the wave equation, we called W of T, well, in honor of wave. And it did the following thing, right? It solved, so D'Alembertian on WT of G was equal to 0. W0 of G was equal to 0. That's the initial position, but partial T, so 1 upon I partial T of W0 of G as a function of X was equal to, well, partial T W0 of G of X was equal to G of X. But of course, I stuck in this tau, so tau W0 of G, which is that, gives me 1 upon I. So that's what the wave, that's what the solution operator for the canonical problem does. And it differs from S by a factor of I. Okay? And so if I have a solution of the canonical problem, how do I make a solution of the usual problem? So solve D'Alembertian U equals zero. I could put an H here, but let's just do F and G initial data. That's just the check. And U at X 0 is equal to F of X, and partial T U of X 0 is equal to G of X. Well, then you do the following thing. You say U of X T has only two terms. That's like the general U having M terms. This is going to have W T applied to G plus. Then what does it tell us to do the second one? It tells us to do tau plus P1 times the solution of M minus 2. M minus 2 is 0. So tau plus P1. P1 is 0. So tau, well, partial T modulo that I that I'm now floating around, W T of F. And that's the solution we had before. Also, you might note is that I'm solving for a problem And then I'm taking a problem, I'm evolving it by the solution operator S, which has certain properties of preserving or maybe changing the smoothness of the data F, and then I differentiate it in order to find the solution. So we have to count very carefully if we want to know precise smoothness. Right? That you find solutions by propagation and also by differentiation, as we've seen with the wave equation. So let's move on. What I want to do is a solution for the general case. So I'm going to go back to my equation P. So I'm going to go back to my equation 1. I'm actually going to solve equation 3 and 4. So back to this. To equations 3 with data 4. So the canonical equation. Okay, so let's see. I have to give data. And so far, all I've said is those are functions, and that's the solution. But what does it mean? So I want to do analysis now, and I'm going to take G to be Schwartz class. And then let me operate with G Schwartz class for a little bit. And I'm going to also assume the solution is to be Schwartz class, and let me get an expression out. And then I'll talk about well-posedness, which is a well-posed problem in this hyperbolic sense is going to map Schwartz class to Schwartz class. Okay, so G is Schwartz class. That means I can perfectly well take the Fourier transform, 1 upon root 2 pi the n, e to the minus I c dot x, g of x dx, integral over Rn. And when u x t is also in Schwartz class, well, in x, parameterized by t, I guess that's what the point of view I'm going to take on. I'm going to look at Schwartz class in x and a parameter family in t, that's that curve of solutions in Schwartz class. Then u of x t is going to be equal to 1 upon 2 pi, I guess I'm using the inversion formula, 1 on 2 pi to the n, e to the I c dot x, leave a gap in your notes, u hat c t d c. And if I operate with the differential operator, p d tau, the whole point of using this notation in the very beginning was that it looks nice when you take Fourier transforms. So p d tau, remember that tau is 1 upon I partial t, but d interacts with c. This is an x Fourier transform. So that gives the following thing. It gives a polynomial here, p, where every time you see a d, you get a c, but every time you see a tau, you get a 1 upon I, and I'm going to be slightly particular and say it's a d by dt. Because that's a function of only one variable that's being differentiated. It's an ODE, and xi has become a parameter. And now, if I want to solve a canonical problem that has initial data, and so that looks as I take j many derivatives of u at x, and I evaluate that at time equals 0, so that looks like, under Fourier transform, 1 upon 2 pi, still to the n, integral over Rn, e to the I, c dot x. And tau j is 1 upon I, d by dt, to the jth power, on u hat of c when t is equal to 0. Again, d c. And I want, now this is the general initial problem. Oh, I haven't given any data yet, so I want this, let's give data. I want this to be 0 for j equals no derivatives, one derivative, all the way up to m minus 2 derivatives, and I want this to be equal to 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral e to the I c dot x, and my function g hat dx when J is equal to M minus 1, of course. That's the canonical problem. And it motivates the study. I mean, it's just what we did in probably the first day of class, maybe second day. Motivates the study of that ODE with parameters, with the parameter C. So we have to study the ODE. So we study the ODE. So it's an nth order ODE. It's a scalar ODE, but of nth order with a parameter C, which floats around in n dimensions. So it's an n-dimensional parameter. I need to know the solution for all n dimensions. And if, let me just repeat that. And then use the Fourier inversion formula, say that if I know this, then I know this. If this is equal to 0, then this is equal to 0, and vice versa. So I want to study this. It's an ODE. It's a polynomial in t derivatives of u. There's some i's in there. It's a complex polynomial with t derivatives of u with data g hat. So I want to study, of course, p. There's the parameter, 1 upon I, d by dt, operating on u hat c t. I want that to be equal to 0. And I also want to study with the initial data, d by dt, to the j's power on u hat xc 0. I want that to be either 0, j equals 0, up to m minus 2, and I want this to be g hat of c when j is equal to m minus 1. And one more thing, sorry to be slightly tedious over this. As soon as I know a fundamental solution to the ODE, then I can find all solutions. So I need a fundamental solution. So that is a function z, which depends on the parameter c, and it depends on time t. And it solves the problem, which almost looks like this. And I'm going to give that problem a 3, 4. I'm going to give it a number 5. So that's 5, which is, I need that polynomial, depends on that parameter c, and 1 upon I, d by dt, in the lambda place, z of c of t, I want that to give me 0. So it's a solution. It's a fundamental solution. At least it's a solution. And then I want 1 upon I, d by dt, this to the power j, operating on z of c and t, I want that to be equal to, again, always 0 when j is 0, 1, up to m minus 2, but I want to give me 1 when j is equal to m minus 1. And then if I have a fundamental solution z, how do I make u? Well, then u hat of c t is simply z of c t g hat of c, as simple as that. So I have to study z. And if I then just invert this little formula here, I have a Fourier, and it's all formal. I'm just doing algebra. So it's all formal. So I just now and just invert. I find u of x and t is equal to the Fourier inversion formula on that. So 1 of 2 pi to the n, integral over Rn, e to the I c dot x. Exactly that. Z of, you can't quite see it. Well, we'll put it down here. Z of c t g hat of c dc. And that's what a solution should look like. Which means, because this is an analysis class at heart, it means all the content is controlling z. If we can control z, we can solve the problem. And we can solve the canonical problem, and then we can differentiate it in these combinatorial ways to solve the full problem. Okay? So, finding expression for the solution in terms of z is not the problem. The problem is that, actually, as long as g has a Fourier transform, And as long as we solve z, we can always find u hat. The problem is really inverting it. This could be a Schwarz class function. This is some parameterized family of ODEs. ODEs aren't a problem. It's a linear ODE. But you might get something so horrendously growing in C that you can't perform the inversion formula. So the analysis goes into Z so we can actually invert. There's no problem until we try to invert, to tell you the truth. So we have to understand Z. So let me make a statement. Which is the Fourier inversion invert formally. Formally, this expression should hold, but of course, the right-hand side might be infinity at every point. It depends on z. The Fourier inversion, so I want to get conditions under which we can invert. So the Fourier inversion formula will hold if, not an if and only if, but if and only if is harder, but if, say, for all, here's one condition where it works. You take all C and T in Rn plus 1, so all parameters C and all T, you take Z to the C T, and you take beta many derivatives, and that does not grow too fast. So bounded by some constant, maybe it depends on alpha. Maybe it only depends on beta, some constant beta times 1 plus, times, let me see, C squared plus 1 to say the alpha over 2, where alpha is going to be chosen by beta. So let's think about it. Suppose G is Schwarz class. And suppose we then multiply it by, Z is a solution of an ODE, and the ODE depends on the parameters, and the parameters enter in a polynomial way. So the solution of the ODE is going to be perfectly smooth in those parameters. So it's even the question of growth in the parameters C is what matters. So Z is going to be perfectly smooth in C. If it's controlled growth, then we take G, it's Schwarz, we take G hat, it's Schwarz, we multiply by something which is perfectly smooth, actually, ODE, which is a solution of a polynomial, perfectly smooth, and if that doesn't ruin the growth, that is, if it only multiplies by something which is only grows possibly polynomially, this is also Schwarz. So if I have this estimate, the solution operator maps Schwarz class to Schwarz class. So that's what I want to do. So with this estimate, that's what I want to say. With this estimate, S of T will map Schwarz class to Schwarz class. And that's the question we want to study. Doesn't have to be uniform in T. So C beta can depend on T. Thank you. Thanks. And the point to avoid is Z solves an ODE. ODEs are famous for having exponentially growing solutions, possibly. So the point you want to avoid is having Z grow exponentially in C over a bounded set of T. Then you're in trouble. It can grow exponentially in T, just as long as when T is bounded, you have C bounds, okay? And that's the issue. And one more thing is, if this is for all beta, so I have to check it for all beta, because I have to take lots of derivatives of Z with respect to beta in order to make the solution go. But because of the equation, it also suffices to check for 0 less than or equal to beta, less than or equal to m minus 1. Because if you know all this and you want to check the mth time derivative, it's, you use the equation. The nth time derivative is equal to minus all those other terms in the equation. So it even just suffices to choose to study finitely many betas. So we've proven a proposition with this little discussion. So proposition for point 19, which says the following. It suffices to show that for any positive time, there is a constant C, which is a function of that time, possibly a function of that time, such that for 0 less than or equal to j, less than or equal to, less than even will do, m, and 0 less than or equal to t, less than or equal to that capital T, that many derivatives of z, of c, t, are bounded by that constant times c to the alpha. Now, I'm just going to introduce the following notation. This way of bounding things comes up so often that I'm going to make a definition of notation that c, and I could call it bracket c. I hope I'm not insulting anybody by saying that it has occurred in so many complicated Japanese papers that often, at least in mathematical physics, you call it the Japanese symbol. I thought that's sort of a joke. Hope it doesn't insult anyone. It's c squared plus 1, the square root, smooth function of c. And that says it doesn't grow faster than Japanese symbol of c. It doesn't have the same smoothness and zero properties of just the absolute value of c. Okay? Suffices this for us to show that. Definition. And that's 420. Gording's condition. And that goes as follows. The equation, the polynomial equation, the partial differential equation, so the PDE, d tau u equals 0 is hyperbolic. Sort of as a definition of the definition of the word hyperbolic, to tell you the truth, if there exists a constant C, so I'm going to start writing over here, such that the polynomial P C lambda does not have roots for all C. I'll put this here. Such that for all C in Rn, there are no roots with lambda in the complex, such that imaginary part of lambda is less than that constant. Two things. One, I want to draw a picture of that, but second thing first. Being hyperbolic is going to mean it satisfies that inequality. Being hyperbolic will then therefore mean that the solution operator maps Schwarz class to Schwarz class. Being hyperbolic and using a duality argument, that also means that the solution operator will map tempered distributions to tempered distributions, being the duals to the Schwarz class. So we're focusing on being able to solve these equations in the tempered distributions, you might say. But all we have to do is make an estimate for that ODE. That's the circle of ideas. So we're doing something big, showing that the solution operator is well defined on tempered distributions, but that task is reduced to an estimate for an ODE. Okay, that's second thing first. First thing second, let me draw a picture of this. Let me draw a picture of this situation. Well, P is a polynomial. And so it's for any C, the fundamental theorem of algebra says that it's a product. So it's lambda minus roots. Lambda j, which depend on xi, j equals 1 to m, because it's an nth order polynomial. Now, the lambda xi's, it's this famous thing that they behave in a complicated manner with respect to parameters and are not necessarily smooth. They can be taken to be continuous in xi, but often not too much more. Nonetheless, they exist. And they move in C. So what we want to now do is look where they lie in the complex plane. So here's the complex plane. This is real lambda, and this is imaginary lambda. And these roots lie places. So here's maybe lambda 1 of C, and here's lambda 2 of C, and here's maybe lambda 3 of C. And they move around as you move around C. So Gordian's condition is that there's a line down here. Imaginary part of lambda equals minus c. I guess I meant to have a minus there because my constants are then positive. And no matter how these move around as you move c, they don't go below this line. And of course, that's designed for evolution into the future. And I said that for all time greater than zero, there's a constant c. Now, we're going to have to reverse, we're going to have to take a complex conjugate to move into the past. That's okay. I'm talking about future time, and I did that from board one. Yes? We'll get to that. But if I say it now, I lose the drama. Very good question, but we'll get to that. Okay? So, good. So let's move on. And what I'm going to do is write down the following lemma and prove it, and then we'll have a break. And what we'll do is do the estimates after the break. Actually, I'm a little bit late, so let me not do that plan. Let me stop now and say that on that little piece of blank blackboard, I'm going to start doing the analysis of this problem. But in any case, the problem is set up. We're doing something big, a flow for a PDE, for a Cauchy problem for a PDE in the tempered distributions, but it's actually estimating a parameterized parameter family of ODEs. Let's have a break. Okay, let's carry on. We define the Gordon condition, then I have to say something about that. So that will be a lemma 4.21, I think. Did I get that right? Yeah. Which is the fundamental solution z of c zt of the ODE 5, I think it is, can be represented as a Cauchy integral. So I do the following thing. Z of C and T is equal to, and that's going to be my expression 6, 1 upon 2 pi I, integral over a contour which might depend on C, E to the I lambda T divided by P of C lambda d lambda, where for we need to have C real vectors. Gamma is possibly gamma C, let's put it over there, is a contour around all roots of the symbol T, C, lambda. And just to be very graphic about it, here are the roots. Just make sure you make a contour which goes around them. And as they move around, move the contour, making sure the contour still goes around them. Okay. And so, it's just an ODE. What we have to do is make sure that this expression 6 satisfies our equation 5, which is that. So, let's just check. So I take Z. It's, you're very right. It's not a fundamental solution. I guess it could be called a fundamental solution because we proved we can get any solution from this solution. I'll call it the canonical solution. You're actually absolutely right. It really should be the canonical solution. So the canonical solution. So let's see what expression we have. We have this, zct is equal to lots of 1 over 2 pi i's, integral over gamma, e to the I lambda t divided by a polynomial, by the polynomial, p c lambda d lambda over the contour. And we have to apply p c tau to this, 1 upon I d by dt to this. And if we do that, xi is just the parameter xi, but of course the famous story about the complex exponential, 1 upon I time derivatives just bring down lambdas. So I get in here, indeed I preserve the factor e to the I lambda t, but I get a p c lambda times it. So the roots cancel. And then I contract gamma to zero, and I get zero by Cauchy's theorem. So at least it satisfies the ODE. And then we have to test what it does when t is equal to zero. So let's test the initial data. the initial conditions. And those go as follows, 1 upon I, d by dt, and I have to take this, say, let's test the jth initial condition, d by dt to the j, at z, now in the parameter c, then I set the t equals 0, well, that's equal to 1 upon 2 pi I, integral over that contour. J many powers of this give me, of course, a lambda to the j, e to the I lambda t, divided by p c lambda, d lambda. And I just want to remind you what this looks like. So it's 1 upon 2 pi I, integral over that contour lambda. Well, there's, oh, and then I set t, I have to set t equals 0. So that's going to be lambda to the j, always in the numerator. When it's at t equals 0, the exponential is 1. And the denominator, let me remind you what that looks like. That looks like lambda to the m plus p1 of c lambda to the m minus 1 plus all the way down to plus pm of c with no powers of lambda. And then d lambda. So for, well, let's do 0, j could be 0, or it could be all the way up to m minus 2. What does the integrand look like if I actually take that contour out to infinity? So I take this contour, and I move it to infinity, which I'm allowed to do, and the integrand looks like, oh, it's unchanged by that contour deformation, to a sphere of radius r, which is large, r, around 0. But the integrand looks more and more like 1 upon lambda to the m minus j, or lambda to the j minus m, d lambda. And up here, this power is at least 2. So j minus m is at least less than or equal to minus 2. And so this is equal to 0 by the Cauchy integral formula. You integrate. Sorry? No, I'm taking the circle in lambda complex.
So how do you know that
P is a polynomial. Sorry?
How do you know that there are no poles?
Because, well, it's divided by a polynomial whose all whose poles are inside. That's the definition of the gamma. It goes around all the roots. The only poles are the roots of the polynomial. And you deform it out for large r. For large r, one c at a time. One c at a time, and you move this out. We're not using this line yet. I'm not using that yet. I'm just showing that I have a fundamental solution. Then I have to estimate that fundamental solution. That's another dilemma. And all I have to do is one more thing for j equals m minus 1. What do I have? This thing looks like 1 upon 2 pi I. So I do the same thing. J is equal to m minus 1, but now, of course, these are all small compared with this, and m minus 1 over m is 1 over lambda. So I have this, and it's equal to, it's not asymptotic to, it's equal to, right, SR0 around a large ball of 1 upon lambda, d lambda, which is equal to 1 by the Cauchy integral formula. So it indeed is a fundamental solution, there's no question. So we proved our lemma. What remains is some quantifying of the polynomial and showing that, in fact, under Gordon's condition, it actually gives us a well-defined solution, so some growth bounds. So it remains to show that there are bounds on growth as Xi varies in Rn. That's the most important thing. And that, I haven't invoked anything other than polynomial, that affects the polynomial right now. Now we need the Gordon condition. So that's lemma 4.22. Oh, and it reminds me, that was a very good comment that Alex made, that this is not a fundamental solution, it's a canonical solution. And I want to just, I wrote the wrong thing. I'm going to put it in my notes. Good. Oops, lost my place. Good. So that's lemma 4.22, which is given the Gordon condition, the roots of the symbol I take it back. Let me erase a little bit. And let me ray out something in my notes. It was getting late last night. For any polynomial, for P, C, lambda, a polynomial, the roots satisfy the estimate the lth root, of course it depends on Xi, is not bigger than some constant, of course it's going to depend on the polynomial, times the Japanese symbol Xi. One power. It depends on still a problem with this. Because it has to start with a lambda to the m, our form, plus p1 c lambda the m minus 1 plus etc. Sorry, the polynomial that we're discussing. For P, the polynomial that we're discussing, I guess I should say. The roots satisfy this estimate. All roots satisfy that estimate. It doesn't mean that that canonical solution doesn't behave very badly exponentially, but the roots always satisfy this estimate. And they could be very badly complex, but they still satisfy this estimate. So, proof. We write again, write P, C, and lambda. It's lambda to the M plus P1 of C, lambda to the M minus 1, plus, etc., PM of C, as before. And for, let's see, the following thing. For each 1 less than or equal to K, less than or equal to M, for all parameters C and Rn, the the PKs can't grow very much, so they're bounded by some CK, C to the K, right? Because the P1 has at most order 1 in C, but could have order 0 plus order 1 parts, etc. So a root P of Xi and then lambda L of Xi equals 0 has to satisfy, well, it satisfies lambda M is equal to minus P1 of Xi lambda M minus 1 minus, etc., all the way down to minus PM of Xi. So in particular, lambda M, so see, that root lambda to the M is less than or equal to sum CK Xi to the K lambda to the M minus K. And let's get rid of all these lambdas and Xi's and just simplify things a little bit. Let's just divide. Let's set theta to be equal to a real number, which is the size of lambda over the size of Xi. Not quite homogeneous, but it will do. And then let's just divide this whole thing by Xm. So this whole thing is really lambda over Xi to the mth power, which that's theta to the m, and it's less than or equal to sum, oh, this is k equals 1 to m minus 1, k equals 1 to m minus 1, some ck's, and then I divide ck by cm, I have m minus k, so I have theta to the m minus k. And either two things can happen. Either theta is less than or equal to 1, but if theta is less than 1, that implies that that root, lambda L, is less than 1 times Xi, right? Or else, theta is bigger than or equal to 1. Well, I guess I don't even have to do the equal. And that says the following thing. Then says theta m is less than or equal to a bunch of constants. So whereupon, theta the m is less than or equal to a bunch of constants times this, times m minus k. Well, if it's bigger than 1, I can just put this up to the maximum power, and I only increase it. And then I take the constants and I make a sum c 0 out of it. Theta to the m minus 1. Right, if theta is bigger than 1, increase this power all the way up to the maximum power represented, which is m minus 1. Take all the constants, make them a c naught. Cancel m to get 1 and m minus 1 to get 0. And theta is bounded, which is to say that lambda for root is bounded by some constant times xi. So done. Very easy. It's a bound, standard bound on roots of polynomials, and the only thing I used was that the coefficient of the lambda to the m was 1. You can do a lot better. This is all I need. Okay, let's see. Fix C and Rn, and factor the symbol. So that's P C lambda is equal to some J is equal to 1 up to M of lambda minus those factors, lambda J of C. So lambda J are the roots. They could be distinct, they could be smooth, they could be non-distinct, they could be not smooth. You can make them continuous, but whatever they are, they're there. I want to do the following. I'm going to construct the contour a little bit more carefully, and that looks like this. But I'm going to construct the contour gamma a little more carefully now. So I want a constructor, so construct gamma. So I'm in the process of estimating z, my canonical solution. So construct gamma, which is going to be gamma, it will depend on c, a bit more carefully. So I want to do that. Let's see, I'm going to do that in pink now. I just sort of made a contour which is big enough to surround them all. Now I'm going to bring that contour down so that I'm going to make a circle of radius 1 around each root. So that's radius 1. Then here, I'll make a circle of radius 1 around that root, and a circle of radius 1 around this root. Of course, I want one contour. So I want this to be gamma. And so to get things so that you're connect, so that it's a connected contour, I make little connecting bridges where I need to. But if those circles overlap, take out the overlapping bit. And the property that I'm preserving is that the contour is at least distance 1 from each root. Say that explicitly. Property of gamma. Yeah, I agree, it depends on C. One is the distance of gamma to each lambda L is greater than or equal to 1. And two, all lambda L's are inside gamma. Distance greater than or equal to 1. Where it was less than, it was kept it at 1 from one root, but where it got close to another root, I erased it. And that forced those two circles to intersect, so I can carry on making that contour. Okay? So now ignore any connecting links. So ignore any of the connecting links, any of the connections. The length of gamma is equal to, well, less than or equal to 2 pi, it's around each circle, times the number of roots. Furthermore, remember that I'm a factorization, and recall that P C lambda was equal to a product J equals 1 to M of lambda minus lambda J of C. So if the distance from on gamma to each root is bigger than or equal to 1, each of these factors has value bigger than or equal to 1. So P C lambda is bigger than or equal to 1 for lambda on gamma. And that's a really good thing because we're dividing by it. And now I want to, let's write this z down again and inspect it. Z of c and t is equal to 1 upon 2 pi I integral over that gamma. That more carefully constructed gamma. What is it again? E to the I lambda t over P c lambda d lambda. And I just worked on finding a nice contour so the denominator is not too small. It's good. How big is the numerator? So if I get the denominator right, how big is the numerator? So check, well, estimate the numerator. Well, this needs Gording condition. So let's see. So we take lambda in gamma. So the imaginary part of lambda can't go more negative than that minus c, but the contour is allowed to be of length 1. So you can go 1 down from c, but still bounded. That's the worst that the imaginary part can be negative. And remember, recall, t we're taking 2 forward in time. So t is a positive number. The worst negative imaginary part, that is a positive exponent, could be minus c plus 1. So that means that z of c t in absolute value is equal to, of course, the absolute value of 1 over 2 pi I integral over the contour e to the I lambda t over p c lambda d lambda. I want to say that it's less than or equal to a bunch of constants. But what's most important is e to the, how big can this be? C plus 1 times t. Now let's see what else there is. There's a length of the contour, there's the size of p, and there's a 1 over 2 pi I. So there's some c0. Did I forget anything? Well, if a root can be here, the contour can be here, which is 1 down. So the worst the root can get is on this dotted line, which is imaginary part minus c. But then I take a contour distance 1 around it, so I'm going to have to add 1. But this is not the only thing we wanted to do. We had to take tau to the j on this. So that brought down lambda to the j here. But lambda to the j changed this a little bit, and it gave us, where can lambda be on that contour? Well, that's where we use the lemma. On the contour, you cannot be further than 1 away from here, which is 1 away from c. So that, at most, that lambda to the j gives us this c naught plus 1, because we're allowed to be distance 1 away from lambda, times, to the j's power, because there are j of them, times c to the j. And now I can stop. Yes. Sorry? Cauchy's theorem. Well, 1, the integral over this plus the integral over this, because of analyticity, I can just erase it. The integral over this is equal to the integral over that minus it, so I erase it. So Cauchy's theorem, I guess. That's this. Lambda to the j has to be at most, on a contour, can be at most 1 distance from a root. And where are the roots? They cannot be bigger than a constant times Japanese symbol xi. So lambda to the j is some constant distance from Japanese symbol C to the J. And that's our estimate. In fact, we're done, aren't we? So then we can state a theorem, which is theorem of 4.22, I'm running out of 23, which is, under Gording's condition, for C real, so C and Rn, and for 0 less than or equal to T less than or equal to some choice of capital T, then J many derivatives of Z to the C T less than or equal to some constant, I keep on calling things C0 and C1, so I'll make C2, Japanese symbol, to the J, E to say C3T. Hence, the solution operator whose Fourier multiplier is Z, Z of C. The solution operator S of T, maps Schwarz class to Schwarz class, and by duality, temperature distributions to temperature distributions for T greater than 0. Okay, it's always nice to use complex variables. On the other hand, it's always nice to have explicit expressions. And instead of integrals, what do you think? Trig functions rather than integrals. And so I'd like to do a couple of special cases. It is an if and only if. I've proved the Gording's condition is an estimate which shows that the solution is well posed. Vice versa, Gording showed, and I won't show, that it's necessary as well. I showed sufficiency. And that's a little more work. Okay, so I failed to mention that. Sorry, that's an important point. Gording showed the other way. So let's take special cases. So case one, which is suppose P, C, lambda, for some reason, has distinct roots. So it's if P has distinct roots. Well, then of course you can always evaluate a Cauchy integral by the calculus of residues, but it's easy if the roots are distinct. So that gives a formula. Then there's a formula which you'll all put into a theorem. 4.24, when lambda j, c are all distinct. That means for all c, or more or less for all c. Then z of c t, well, let's see. We must have a Z of CT must have an expression. Oh, here's, take off the absolute values. We have an expression for Z of CT. That's a Cauchy integral I'm going to evaluate at the roots by the calculus of residues. So it's going to be 1 upon 2 pi I. Oh, here it is. 1 over 2 pi I gamma e to the I lambda t over the polynomial C lambda d lambda. But then if I evaluate this over using a calculus of residues at each root, I have j equals 1 to m, 1 for each root. At that root, I have to take the lambda derivative of p, so let's call that, say, the tau derivative of p, evaluated at the root, so c lambda j c. And then I get e to the I lambda at that root, lambda j c t. That's an expression. Or the solution. Well, one should also do examples. So, example of choice is, again, the wave equation. So, the symbol P, C, lambda is equal to sum of CJ squared, J equals 1 to N, minus lambda squared, and roots are real. That is, what are the roots? Well, lambda 1 of C, say, is equal to length of C, and lambda 2 of C, it's a second order, so there's 2, is equal to, say, minus C. That's it. And they're distinct, well, except when C equals 0. So let's sort of ignore that. Let's evaluate it in the case that C is not equal to 0. Then we have an expression for it. And in fact, we'll get the case C equals 0 for free. And then what does this expression give? Well, it's a sum of two things, right? So Z of T equals, let's see, the first one is E minus, by reasons of something or other, E to the I C T over 2C, because that's this thing, plus E to the minus I C T over 2C, and if I put these two together, thus the solution U of XT of the canonical problem is you just make those, you make it out of those, which is, and I'll just write down the solution, U of XT is equal to, well, that's, there's that I because of the tau rather than d by dt, and so over root 2 pi to the n. I'm just writing down z, and then I put it into the solution of the canonical problem, integral over rn, e to the I c dot x, sine of ct, that's what you do when you take a difference of complex exponentials, over C, G hat of C, dx, and that should look familiar. Sorry? I was going to say that's the wave kernel in Fourier space that we derived third lecture, or maybe the fourth lecture. So this has initial data, so we just check that U of X 0 is equal to, well, what happens to this when t is equal to 0? It's 0 because sine of 0 is 0. So u of x 0 is equal to 0, but partial t of u of x 0 is equal to, well, there's that I there, I g of x. That means tau of u 0 is equal to g, solution to the canonical problem. So the last thing I want to consider, and then I'll stop, this is 1 hour lecture, I thought, when I was preparing it. So the last thing I want to talk about, a second special case, is case one, so case two. What happens if P is homogeneous? So P of D tau homogeneous, if is homogeneous. It could be. So that means, and so it's an mth order operator, so it's homogeneous of degree m. So we do the following thing. P of alpha c alpha lambda is equal to alpha to the m times P of c lambda. And this is for alpha, a real number. You're not allowed to complex dilation. It's real dilation. Okay? Then, so if so, let's make it homogeneous. Suppose there were a root with non-zero imaginary part. Suppose lambda j of c, a root with imaginary part of lambda j of c, not zero. That is, P of C and lambda J C equals zero, and imaginary is not zero. Then of course, what happens? If P of alpha C, alpha lambda J of C, is a root, so lambda, at least some root, lambda, well, if we label them right, I guess we can, lambda J of alpha C turns out to be modulo labeling continuously, alpha times lambda J of C. And this is for all alpha real. So imaginary part of alpha of lambda J of alpha C can grow, so as long as it's non-zero, suppose it's positive, then take alpha very negative. Then imaginary part of lambda G can go to minus infinity, choosing alpha properly. That is going alpha going to either plus or minus infinity, depending on which way you need to ruin it. In particular, Gording cannot hold. So Gording cannot hold. So if you want a hyperbolic, so if you want a problem which is homogeneous to be hyperbolic, it better only have real roots, and that's something that we were discussing just a few moments ago. Does it have real characteristics? If it's homogeneous, it has to have real characteristics. They're related to the roots, and those are the real roots. So that's... Right. Well, I mumbled over it. I was going to say lambda L. There's some root. But since roots behave homogeneously, you can actually label them by homogeneity. So you can actually, once you have a root, you just move it out by moving alpha. And that remains a root, and you don't even have to worry each C or each alpha which root you're on. So you even can do it where it's the same root. But it's a root. You can move an A root as far negative imaginary part as you want. So it violates Gording. Okay, and then my last thing is, well, what happens for a general polynomial? And this is where the origin of the idea of real principal type in general. This is the third way I'm going to decompose the polynomial today. In general, this operator, P d tau, can be written in terms of its homogeneous powers. So that says P d tau is equal to P m d tau plus P m minus 1 d tau plus down to P 0 d tau. And with Pj of d tau, of alpha c, alpha lambda is equal to alpha to the j, Pj of c lambda. So these p's are different from the previous p's because it's the homogeneous parts dilation in x and t, sorry, c and tau. And I don't know, have a better notation other than that maybe I could put them superscript, but anyway, we understand. Right? And then, so I have a theorem about this. So theorem, which is a 4.25, which is in order that the Gording condition holds, it for P, it is necessary that the principal symbol which is precisely Pm, the nth order homogeneous part, C lambda, have only real roots. And the proof is, well, you have to find roots. So zero, you have to find roots of the whole thing. So here's the proof. in a 1 minute sketch. You have to find roots of the full symbol. So you have alpha C. You have to find roots C, lambda J C. And let's just multiply C by alpha. Let's move out radially. And let's do the following thing. Let's also just move this radially and divide by, what am I doing? I'm doing something a little screwy here, so I have to, let me redo it. I have to find roots P of C, lambda J C. I have to find that, and that equals zero. So let me do the following thing. That's the full symbol. That's Gordon condition discusses the full symbol. So now let me do the following thing. I'll take P alpha C, alpha lambda J C, and I'll divide by alpha to the M. And now that has an expansion, right, which is PM, which is this PM, that's the capital PM, of, that's the homogeneous degree M part. So this M canceled this and this M. So PM of C, lambda J C, plus 1 upon alpha PM minus 1, of its argument, plus 1 upon alpha squared PM minus 2, plus etc. And I guess all I want to say is for large alpha, these are all small. This is the most important. And the roots are going to behave close to the roots of the principal symbol. And if the principal... This is the general case. But the principal symbol is homogeneous. So unless the principal symbol has only real roots, you can send roots of this principal symbol to arbitrary large negative imaginary part, and the roots of the full symbol will follow because they're just going to be perturbations of such. So this is the most important, and it must obey the stipulations of the homogeneous case. Where did I write this down? Of the homogeneous case. Gording is a sufficient condition, but I'm not proving it. It might be. I have to think about that. But let's stop here now that we're out of time. And I have another topic to go on to, and I was expecting to do that starting an hour ago. So it just shows I underestimated Gording. But I'll tell you what I want to talk about, and I'll start next time, which is symmetric hyperbolic systems. First, I'll give a definition. They're generally a quasi-linear theory. Then I want to give examples. Oh, then I want to give an estimate, energy estimate, and a finite propagation speed estimate. Then I want to give examples. Those range from wave equation on a Riemannian manifold to compressible Euler's equations of fluid mechanics to Einstein's equations in the appropriate coordinates to harmonic maps where the origin space is a Lorentzian manifold. There's very many things all fit into one rubric under one category that was recognized as important by Friedrichs in the 50s. So I'm going to give you linear theory, and then we'll finish our section on hyperbolic equations by doing nonlinear symmetric hyperbolic systems. Give us a big tool for with many applications. Okay, thanks.